This is Speaking of Purpose, where we talk to real people making real change. In this episode, we're digging into the pressure cooker that is corporate leadership today.
Many companies and corporate leaders feel perhaps slightly squeezed between sort of these two poles where you're kind of damned if you do speak out, but you're damned if you don't.
And Dr. Andrew Jones has the data to back it up. As a principal researcher at the Conference Board, Andrew Jones advises Fortune 500 leaders on how to navigate purpose, profit, and public pressure. So whether it's employee walkouts or shareholder activism, he's here to show us what's shaping corporate decision making. Welcome to the show, Andrew. It's great to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Awesome. So we'd love to just start with a little bit about yourself and your role at the Conference Board.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a principal researcher at the Conference Board in New York. For those who don't know what the Conference Board is, the Conference Board has a long history, and the Conference Board is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, business-oriented membership organization and think tank. So we've been working with, particularly with C-suite leaders and senior executives for many years, helping them support their businesses both to be more effective and also to have a more stronger and more lasting societal impact. And within the Conference Board, I'm actually based in the Governance and Sustainability Center, which is as you can guess from the name, we focus on key issues related to corporate governance, environmental and social sustainability, and also social impact, philanthropy, and corporate citizenship. So it's a busy time right now, for sure.
I can imagine. And so thank you for making the time to come. We actually, earlier this year, identified a report that you had released. So the Conference Board released research that said that the number of anti-ESG proposals more than quadrupled in the Russell 3000 from 2021 to 2024. And that the trend was expected to intensify this year in 2025. So would love for you to just tell us a little bit about that research that you published.
Yeah, sure. And perhaps I should begin by saying that given our focus on corporate governance and broader sort of ESG issues, the Conference Board's been working on shareholder proposals and shareholder activism for many years. So this is something we've been tracking, and it's always interesting, right? Every year it's sort of evolves in step with the times and kind of reflects the broader debates of the day. And something we've seen a lot in the last few years is the rise of what we broadly call anti-ESG proposals, right? So that's proposals coming in mainly at sort of the large companies, the big industry leaders, coming from sort of activist groups and NGOs that are very much opposed to sort of corporate action, whether it's on the environment or on social issues. And it's quite a recent phenomenon. A few years ago, you didn't really see that at all. And in the last years, it's become a larger and larger part of the process. I guess these activists have their own sort of purposes and objectives and goals in doing so, right? Whether it's to challenge companies or to even encourage them to roll back. And they've been particularly active, I'd say, in a few areas, one of which was climate change. And then more recently in diversity, equity and inclusion. And it's been really interesting, right? And it's for those companies that receive this kind of activism, it's difficult. It's difficult to navigate. It sort of complicates, particularly if you're also at the same time also fielding activists from the opposite side of the political and ideological spectrum. So it's a recent phenomenon, but it's something I think that's increasingly a vocal and highly visible part of the proxy season.
And do you find that this activism is coming from some specific groups, or is it more widespread?
So it's a great question. It's actually, I'd say there's quite a broad range of sort of what, I think it's quite a crude term in some ways in the anti-ESG, but I think it kind of captures sort of the positioning and framing and goals of these organizations. But actually, it's just a handful actually that are responsible for the bulk. And some of them you may be familiar with. These are well-known entities, like, for example, the National Center for Public Policy or the National Legal and Policy Center. And these are organizations that obviously have specific goals, specific objectives, specific political and ideological positions. So it's actually a relatively small number of groups. Although it's worth saying, Sonia, you could say the same for the opposite side as well. It's often a small number of groups are responsible for the pro-ESG proposals as well. I think well-known entities like As You Sow and similar organizations. But yes, it's a small but vocal minority for sure.
Yeah. And I think it's fair to say that it's happening on both ends. I think that's a fair and true point. Andrew, do you have a sense of what drove the rise in these shareholder proposals?
Do you mean specifically the anti-ESG proposal?
Yeah.
I think in some ways it was perhaps inevitable, right? Because if you look back a few years, you know, I think to the perhaps the start of this decade, where perhaps enthusiasm and optimism is really at a peak for corporate action on, particularly on the environment and perhaps on social issues and on workforce diversity. And therefore, we saw a lot of proposals come that really pushed companies to act in those areas, right? Whether they were calling for, you know, setting a net zero climate plan or disclosing more information that's more detailed information on the gender or racial diversity of their workforce. So perhaps it was only natural that we'd see the pendulum swing the other way, and we'd see a backlash against that, particularly because we saw a broader backlash against some of that activity in society as a whole, particularly here in the US. So, yeah, I think from sort of around probably about 2-3 years ago, we started to see the shareholder proposal process being polarized in a similar way, to be honest, that American society and the business landscape is polarized in general. So I think the drivers for this are ultimately, yes, they reflect a certain view of like the corporation and reflect either a support or a backlash against a view that the corporation should be acting on social issues, on environmental issues, should be disclosing. So I think it was a natural reaction to a lot of that work.
Right. And so now that we're well into 2025, I'm curious about how this trend has played out. In the news right now, it seems as though the news cycles around shareholder activism have abated somewhat, and that most shareholders are voting down these proposals, but would love your view, like getting the facts.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting proxy season this year. And I'd say in some ways we've seen a continuation of some trends from previous years. So there's actually been a trend for probably the last 2 or 3 years of declining shareholder support for ESG issues, right? Whereas as recently as a few years ago, you know, social proposals, climate-related proposals, DEI-related proposals were consistently gaining a lot of support, gaining a lot of traction from investors and everyday shareholders. A lot more subdued now. And that very much has continued this year and even continued on a decline. We're seeing very few proposals gain significant support or definitely gaining significant support to pass. One interesting trend that we've definitely seen this year is actually a decline in the total number of social environmental proposals. Taking the first sort of few months of this year compared to the first few months of last year, big drop off, particularly in social proposals and human capital proposals. And I think there's many reasons why that is, right? I think is perhaps there's a perception that shareholder proposals maybe aren't as effective as they were a few years ago. And also, I think, speaks to some of the issues we've already discussed around kind of the polarization of the process and the rise of kind of activists on both ends, perhaps pushing agendas. So it's been a very interesting proxy season so far, for sure. And some of the things that I think have been really capturing media attention have been like the proposals around DEI, which makes sense given kind of the broader political environment which we've been in.
And so would you characterize this as a bit of a retreat from stakeholder capitalism back to kind of shareholder primacy?
Well, that's a really great question. I'm not sure I'd go as far as to say we're seeing a retreat from stakeholder capitalism. You know, I think that was there is reasons why we saw that sort of transition in the last few years, right? And I think companies are, particularly your large companies, you know, the publicly traded companies, are very attuned to a broad array of stakeholders, right? I do think that those stakeholder expectations have evolved and are continuing to evolve. And I think when it comes to the shareholder proposal process, I think particularly sort of ESG issues kind of peaked a little bit, you know, and there's many reasons why support has declined, right? It can definitely be attributed to a backlash and political headwinds and I guess a slowing of momentum. But I think there's also a perception, and particularly among many sort of institutional investors and asset managers, that there's less need for these proposals. You know, companies actually made a lot of progress on disclosures and on setting climate goals and on setting social goals and on making tangible progress. And I think there's perhaps a feeling that a lot of the proposals now in these areas are more prescriptive and less compelling than they may have been a few years ago. So I mean, there's a lot going on here, right? There's many reasons behind some of these factors. I wouldn't go so as to call it a retreat just yet, but things have definitely changed, I think, for sure.
Right. So what I'm hearing is maybe there's a bit of stabilization. So, you know, a lot of this was introduced. People have kind of found the momentum, the groove, they're reporting, they're disclosing, they're acting. There is some backlash. I do wonder if there is any data that you've come across or that the conference board has published around how investments in ESG do drive long-term value or their impact on the value of a company.
We've done, I appreciate the question, because we've done a lot on this work, and that work continues to evolve as the landscape evolves as well. But we've consistently seen, and as you know, there is a whole debate here, right, around sort of evidence for and against, and research and debates in the academic world and in the practitioner world around the exact relationship between investments in ESG, you know, and that raises the question, which part of ESG are you talking about? You talk about the environment, you talk about social, you talk about old school governance. But there is clearly evidence for a sort of a direct causal relationship. And we hear this from our member companies, both anecdotally, you know, in the sense that obviously, you know, you invest in sustainability, you invest in environmental sustainability, you can reduce your costs, be more efficient. You invest in social, whether it's investing in human capital, investing in addressing community issues, the company can benefit enormously from that sort of enhanced license to operate, that enhanced sort of reputation and brand that in turn, whether attracts consumers or attracts talent and retains talent. The challenge is often kind of, you know, harnessing the empirical data to show those causal pathways. But I would say that in the last few years, companies and specifically sort of ESG and sustainability leaders have come a long way in being able to articulate that business case both internally and externally. And given the current environment, which is perhaps becoming a little, you know, a little slower and a little tougher, I think the pressure will only increase to show that value.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing that as well. So I love that you kind of started to broaden the scope a bit. Let's keep going with that. Let's broaden out from shareholder activism. So Benevity actually publishes an annual trends report called The State of Corporate Purpose, which this year revealed that 52% of impact leaders in their businesses expected their CEOs to be less vocal on social issues in 2025. But 76% of them also anticipated employee activism. To us, this really reveals this powerful correlation between communication and trust, and that where there is silence, there is risk. How have you seen corporate communication strategies adapting to address this risk?
I think this is such an important area, right? I think your research is brilliant, really, and fantastic, and chimes a lot with what we've heard, right? That in the current moment, I think sort of the peak of companies and specifically perhaps CEOs and corporate leaders speaking out on societal issues, and particularly, you know, controversial or hot button issues, feels like the peak has passed, right? It feels like there's a recognition that maybe there's less to gain than there once was, and to do so is only to invite polarization, to invite scrutiny. But at the same time, as you've highlighted, if you go silent on issues, you're also risk alienating different groups of stakeholders, right? And that includes your own employees, that includes consumers. This is a huge, huge area of tension. And I think many companies have, it's been a struggle to navigate, right? It's been a challenge. And I think many companies and corporate leaders feel perhaps slightly squeezed between sort of these two poles where, you know, you're kind of damned if you do speak out, but you're damned if you don't, right? And which stakeholder group are you most aligned with, and which stakeholder group are you most oriented towards, and so on. But I think we've done some interesting work on this, where we often find that ultimately it should always be brought back to the kind of, I guess, having a clear kind of criteria and clear governance processes and clear sort of steps for speaking out and taking a stance, right? And normally if a company is taking a stand on an issue, it should be a material issue, right? It should be an issue that is relevant to the company. It should be an issue that the company has a position on, has something to offer to the debate, right? And I think going forward, we expect to see perhaps sort of, yeah, more clearer guardrails around these kind of communication work. I mean, much clearer sort of legal oversight and governance oversight. That's probably been a trend coming up for the last couple of years, really, but I think we'll continue in the years to come. But it's an interesting time for sure when it comes to sort of, yeah, these tensions and challenges of yeah, how do you comment on issues and when not to move. It's very difficult, I think.
Yeah, I don't think the course on that has been quite charted yet, but I definitely think what you're saying is true, which is companies are sticking to where they have credibility, authority, or influence, which makes a lot of sense. Are you seeing a difference in the response between private and public companies when it comes to speaking out on issues or CEO vocality?
I think it does vary a lot by company and industry, right? Because I think on the one hand, public and private companies, you know, if they're large entities, they're still going to be subject to a lot of the same pressures, right? You know, whether it's like the internal workforce expectations or the expectations of the communities in which they operate, or even their investors, you know, while the investors look different. But obviously public companies do have, you know, different kind of pressures as well. You know, they're regulated, they're producing so much more commentary and content and filings and you know, they're so obligated to say so much more, and they're under so much more scrutiny, I think. So I think many of the pressures are the same, but I do think public companies are really under the spotlight. And sometimes being a private company, you know, and having those kind of interesting ownership structures and different ways of working, and I guess a bit more of a shield to the outside world, can enable perhaps a different way of steering that course, to use your language, and can enable companies to speak out and operate in different ways. But I think it varies a lot in practice across industries, of course.
Yeah, makes sense. And I would hope that there's some companies that could use that, maybe that private structure as an advantage, both commercially and societally.
For sure. And it's interesting. So we do work a lot with private companies, both big and small. And we do see some really interesting stuff specifically in like the ESG and sustainability space, right? That often private companies they're often seen as, you know, coming late, being late to the party, right? And perhaps being behind their public company peers. But what we often see as well is that sort of that, you know, that liberation from kind of, you know, the quarterly filings and the need for all the sort of the structured kind of governance pieces, and does enable sometimes a bit more creativity. You know, that the sustainability leaders and social impact leaders can spend a bit less time on compliance and you know, meeting with investors, and spend a bit more time actually on strategy and goals and doing the kind of the hard work of making an impact, right? So private companies have challenges, but they also have real opportunities in some of this space as well.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that. I'm going to share just one more bit of research that we uncovered as we were doing our annual trends survey. And it's the fact that 26% of CSR leaders that we surveyed from large enterprises, so both public and private, expressed a lack of confidence in executive leadership's ability to make sound decisions on challenging issues. So what do you think CEOs might be missing?
So I think it's always interesting to talk about CEOs, right? Because the CEO is obviously, we all know, the CEO is the face of the company. The CEO is the mouthpiece of the company. It's the CEO that gets quoted when they are, you know, taking a position on one issue or another. And I think it's interesting that on the one hand, I think CEOs recognize this, and CEOs recognize that there are many stakeholders out there, and that these stakeholders may have different expectations, and they may be expecting the company to take a stand on this particular issue or that particular issue. And obviously, different companies have different, you know, they might have a younger generation consumer base or so on that in turn shapes it. I think many CEOs know all this, you know, they know it, they're not blind to it. But I do wonder sometimes if some CEOs may underestimate stakeholder expectations, right? They may assume that, you know, silence is golden, you know, particularly when it comes to sort of provocative issues or hot button issues. But actually many employees, you know, younger consumers, even investors, right, and other stakeholders may interpret silence as actually avoiding perhaps commenting on issues that are particularly important to them. And I'm thinking issues like climate change or the state of democracy or sort of diversity where we're in the workforce in the local community. And actually by hesitating, you know, which may be very irrational decision to do so, companies can potentially, you know, lose control of a narrative or allow others to sort of to step in and define the company's stance or values for them. I say all this while recognizing just how challenging it is for CEOs to navigate this minefield, right? But I do wonder sometimes if, yeah, there's a tricky sort of tension to navigate here.
Yeah, and I think that maybe also how important these values and statements are to people. So the depth of emotional investment in some of these issues for some communities, some generations, and their expectations are just so different. And I do think they're seeking leadership and they are seeking hope. And I think sometimes CEOs may not believe that that's their role. When in fact, if business is the most trusted institution, you're playing a much bigger role than leading a company.
Yeah, right. And it's, I agree completely. I think really nicely put. And I think obviously, you know, there are many rational reasons why CEOs might be reluctant to whether it's to take stands or to put out messages, you know, having they recognize I had politicized, even straightforward issues can become right, and that there can be unintended consequences. And perhaps there's also a feeling maybe that among CEOs that stakeholders might be forcing companies into sort of, you know, binary positions where they have to be for or against, you know, and they might be more complex in reality. But having said all that, I think I do agree with you that, yeah, that there are intense, you know, there's intense passions and intense expectations. I mean, companies are always, you know, and shouldn't just be looking to now, but to, you know, the years ahead and asking themselves, you know, what will our key stakeholders be expecting? Where are our key markets, right? Where are our future consumers and employees coming from, right? And what do they expect from us? And I think it just sort of underscores the need for perhaps, yeah, not just a boldness maybe, but also maybe an actual framework for principles for speaking out that also takes some of the pressure off the CEO, and it becomes a broader question of kind of the communication strategy and the firm as a whole. But it's a difficult time. It's a difficult place for many CEOs to find themselves.
I love that you brought in the future piece, because I think that's really true and potentially underestimated as well. Like, there is just no way that the businesses of today are the same as the businesses of the future, just given the massive number of macro trend changes. I mean, AI being, of course, one of them, but also climate and, of course, communities and of color or various diverse communities and their needs and the population and demographic changes. It's just massive. So I think that's exactly right. As you were speaking, I was reflecting on the CEO of Marriott, who recently made a statement about how they are going to remain committed to inclusive workforces, which makes a ton of sense for their business because of the workforce that they do have. And it seemed to me it was a very benign statement. It was a very simple statement of, you know, we will welcome everyone. But the amount of positive feedback that he got in an article I read, it said that he got, you know, 49,000 employee emails after saying that. And I think that is speaking to the pent up desire for people to hear from leadership that they still care, as there is all of these, you know, proxies and proposals that are anti. And so I was curious if you also had an example of a CEO who might be really getting it right.
I think it's a really, I mean, first of all, the example you shared is a really nice one, I think. And really, I think I agree with you that sort of, you know, in the current environment, it can be, you can start to believe that, yes, that actually that things have changed so much. And now there is no sort of, the right way forward is simply sort of silence and recalibration and adjusting. And there's a lot of rationale and logic behind that, right? But there remains, you know, there still remains this sort of this enthusiasm, whether it's for diversity, as you illustrated, or whether it's action on the environment or whatever sort of societal issues, right? And I think that remains, particularly whether it's amongst the workforce or amongst consumers, and companies do have to be attuned to that. In terms of an example of a CEO, I think there's quite a few I could point to, whether it's a CEO or a company. And actually a company that I think that's been top of mind for many recently, for sort of perhaps similar kind of example, is Costco. Right. And I think this brings us back to sort of the shareholder proposal process as well. Right. I mean, as many of the listeners probably already know, Costco's faced a prominent anti-DEI proposal earlier this year. You know, got a lot of press coverage. And actually Costco, the board and the CEO came out and delivered a very sort of clear and disciplined response, right? That the company remains committed to inclusion, you know, that was kind of core to the company, and they saw it as linked to kind of the core business and the future of the business. And you know, the result was, first of all, the shareholder proposal itself got very little support. But I think perhaps more fundamentally, you saw a real kind of rallying of popular support for Costco, right? And Costco, I think, really sort of from a communications perspective, really just skillfully sort of leveraged what was a very difficult moment for actually real positive reputational gain, while some of its rivals perhaps handled it in different ways that maybe didn't play out as effectively. So that's one example of many I could point to, I think. You know, I certainly don't want to say there aren't others, but Costco, perhaps given our where we started talking about shareholder proposals, feels particularly relevant, I think.
Yeah, we've actually been tracking Costco as well. And when you look at their business performance in the last quarter, year over year, it's pretty staggering. I think it's really strong evidence of the value that you can build in a company if you stay steadfast in your purpose and in your values. And even just personally speaking, I know a number of people in my community from who are from communities of color saying, like, I actually went to Costco that day. I started shopping more at Costco. And so it's both anecdotal, but it's also being proven out in the data, in their quarterly results.
Yeah. And I think you're right that even like the anecdotal speaks to something, doesn't it? It speaks to how, like, first of all, one, how visible these issues are, right? Now, these are issues and stories that are playing out, you know, they're not niche stories. They're playing out in high profile media, right? They're involving high profile actors and politicians and political representatives and activists. You know, they are high profile, you know, and with that high profile does come, you know, risks for companies, does come, you know, reputational risks, legal risks. It is very difficult, but also comes an opportunity, therefore, to, you know, showcase your, as you said, showcase your commitment to your core values, your commitment to your core customers and communities, and I guess almost an opportunity to show that you do live the things you say, right? And the commitments you've made, and particularly perhaps you might have made a few years ago when it was easier to make them. So I think it's a nice example, and I've heard similar stuff in my circle as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought them up, Andrew. They definitely deserve some spotlighting. I know that the conference board's data also tracks shifts in corporate reputation, which is kind of what we've been talking about. I'm curious to ask, what types of activism have you seen that have the biggest long-term impact on brand trust and consumer perception?
Yeah, it's a really great question, Rex. I think taking a long-term view, often you do see how much things have changed and ebbed and flowed over the years, right? I mean, we started talking about shareholder activism, right? Which is a tried and tested form of activism, right? It's a very specific one, trying to influence corporate governance and strategy. I think that has been a very effective, you know, very effective at driving strategic shifts, particularly in the last few years on ESG issues, right? I'm thinking many companies were encouraged to, for example, set net zero commitments or product divestments off the back of high profile activism. But in terms of like a longer term view and what really impacts on, you know, to your question around sort of brand and reputation and core value, I'd almost point to perhaps something more, you know, something broader and more fundamental than shareholder activism, right? So I'd probably look at either employee activism or consumer activism. You know, and obviously employees can be incredibly effective, right? Employees are obviously insiders, you know, their advocacy can directly affect the firm. When employees publicly push for, you know, more ethical or more purpose-driven behavior, it can have real impacts, you know, whether that's forcing a leadership response or forcing a policy change or generating negative headlines, right? So I think employee activism has consistently shown itself to be highly effective. And on top of that, I think consumer activism is very interesting, particularly given the current moment where we've seen some high profile boycotts in recent years from both sides of the political spectrum, right? And these obviously have been driven by different things. They may be, you know, reactions to companies taking stands or not taking stands or being perceived to be supporting certain issues or not supporting certain issues, but these can really hit a company's bottom line. They can hit revenue, and they can really hit brand reputation as well. So I'd probably point to those two areas as the really sort of, you know, the areas of activism that can have transformational change. Yeah, I think shareholder activism is very effective, but it's effective within very sort of tight parameters, right? I mean, when it comes to boycotts and employees taking stands, it's a whole nother game together.
The power of the people.
Right. indeed. And it's a cliche, and it doesn't always work, and it's not always coherent, and it's not always long lasting. And it's often, you know, it's fractured. But that is often how you see lasting transformation.
We were talking about corporate reputation. We talked a little bit about a few companies that have, you know, taken stands and seen some impact on their business. Is there anything you can share that we've learned about how a company's reaction to any kind of activism can either enhance or detract from their value?
Yeah, I think there is. It's a really great question. I should add that the Commerce Board isn't sort of empirically measuring that sort of in a broad kind of index way. But we do hear a lot from our member companies about, you know, how they have or haven't responded and the perceived impact. I think it ultimately comes down, it's going to look different at different companies, right, in different industries. And obviously, it's going to look different depending on the issue and who the issue is resonating with and the intensity of the feeling and so on. But I think often it does come back to sort of governance and having sort of clear guidelines in place and protocols. And we found the most effective responses tend to be those that are measured and do follow a certain principles, right? So rather than perhaps a kind of very quick, sudden, perhaps the CEO speaking out, you know, which may be very rational and very effective, but we find it may be more, maybe more prudent and more impactful to sort of go through sort of what are the issues? Are these issues material to the company? What is the company's position? You know, what are the stakeholders that we're really trying to serve here? What are the different different opposing viewpoints we need to navigate? What do our employees think? You know, so listen to your employees, listen to your employee resource groups. What do our consumers think? What do our communities where we operate think? And I think ultimately a response that is informed by those kind of considerations, you know, and is thoughtful and intentional and grounded in the company's value and purpose, that tends to be the most effective way forward, particularly when it is a divisive, hot button, polarizing issue where there may not be a clear consensus on what is the right way forward or not.
That is such sensible guidance and wisdom to give. And I think it's heartening because you're encouraging deep thought across the stakeholder ecosystem for a company, which I think is important, often not valued in this society where we live for speed and instant gratification. And that's the one thing I would say that has been a real challenge in this space is companies and CEOs are asked to react so quickly. And if they don't react quickly, they come under fire. But if you do kind of make a trade-off between reacting quickly and reacting well.
You do, yeah. I mean, really nicely put. And yeah, we it's such a good point because we know how intense the news cycle is. We know how intense kind of the pressure is. Yeah, you're so right that many times companies and particularly leaders may not feel they have the liberty of sort of, you know, taking a measured response and dwelling and being able to convene teams and gather information, right? It's totally understandable why you may feel that intensity and that imperative to move forward and to move forward quickly and to step out. But I think if you're able to actually sort of, yeah, taking a bit of the heat out of it, you know, being able to reflect and not react in a sort of emotional way, but actually be kind of data driven and dispassionate and disciplined is very, very effective. And we've heard this a lot. I mean, as we're talking, I was thinking about some of the work we've done in the last few years on ESG backlash, you know, and how companies can navigate sort of anti-ESG sentiment. One of our recommendations there was really to sort of avoid kind of the emotional reaction and do try and meet critics where they are and sort of look carefully at what you say and take the opportunity to refresh and recalibrate your own language and strategy and even perhaps treat criticism and difficult moments as an opportunity rather than a challenge, right? Easier said than done, of course, but these are hopefully helpful and pragmatic tips in what is increasingly a very difficult and provocative environment.
You know, right or wrong, one of the things I often do is think about the advice that I'm given as a leader and think about how that applies to leadership more broadly. And we often say feedback is a gift. And so at some level, that criticism is a gift because it's people who care enough about an issue and care enough about your brand to actually say something. And so I think it can be treated in the way you described. Like you said, it's not easy, but I'm not sure much is easy these days anyway. So we're in the soup. So
indeed. And it's funny because everyone, no one, we all struggle to receive constructive criticism and honest feedback, right? It's only human nature. But I think we would agree as well that, yeah, we all benefit when we receive that honest feedback, right? And that's how we improve. And companies are no different, that actually, you know, companies always benefit from understanding what their stakeholders think, right? It's part a huge thing that underpinned kind of this transition to stakeholder capitalism and the rise of ESG strategies, right? Being attuned to that broader spectrum of stakeholders and in doing so, you know, not only being able to act in a more impactful and positive way, but also being able to identify risks and opportunities sooner than they might have done. And I think that principle still holds today.
Yeah, I think that's a powerful insight. So some would argue that having a corporate purpose that encompasses investments in fostering a positive impact on communities, for example, so the social side, or on the planet, so the environmental side, can dilute focus from shareholder returns. What do you say to the leaders wrestling with that tension?
I think it's an understandable tension. You know, it is, particularly if we spoke earlier about sort of the difficulty sometimes of of being able to show with data and hard evidence the return, the business return of some of these investments, even if you can perceive them anecdotally, right? But I guess what I would say is that, yeah, there is a strong body of evidence and a strong body of learnings and a strong body of case studies that show that we shouldn't necessarily view, you know, corporate purpose, sustainability, so impact, however you want to call it, as diametrically and binary opposed to shareholder returns, right? That actually, whether it's through managing risk better or engaging stakeholders more effectively, or, you know, boosting the corporate reputation that in turn attracts customers and attracts employees and retains the best talent, there is a clear business case for this work, right? And as companies move into what looks like a very sort of uncertain era and very uncertain few years ahead, you know, big disruptions on the horizon, I think having that sort of that clear sense of purpose and having kind of a clear understanding of your sort of your social environmental footprint and your community impacts is going to be extremely valuable, yeah, and will sort of help companies whether manage risk or boost returns very effectively in the years to come.
Yeah, I think that's right. I often think, you know, 10 years from now, we'll look back at this time as an inflection point. You know, 2020 was definitely an inflection point in business, but I actually think this period we're in around, you know, you referred to the pendulum swinging and then kind of correcting. I actually think that what we're seeing is a stabilization into a period where these things are more balanced and therefore feels more sustainable. And therefore feels like it might be laying down the groundwork for the future of business.
I completely agree. I do think what the last few months and the years ahead are really critical time period, right? I think we are seeing an ongoing recalibration of sustainability, of social impact, of purpose, and perhaps some of the grander ambitions are being maybe sort of trimmed down a little bit, right? But I think what you're seeing is perhaps a more disciplined, more sort of business oriented, more risk oriented, and more perhaps mature version of a lot of these initiatives and investments emerge, right? And ultimately, in the long term, that may be more resilient, you know, maybe more actually aligned with the business and what the business is trying to achieve. And in doing so, perhaps we'll be here to stay for and outlive kind of, you know, political headwinds and political swings and regulatory swings. So, yeah, I agree. I think these are interesting times, you know, and with some of the disruptions on the horizon, I think this work is more important than it's ever been. It's just perhaps going to be spoken about and approached and messaged and invested in perhaps a different kind of way.
Yeah, it's changing shape. So, Andrew, we're coming to the end of this conversation. And so I have one final question. This podcast is called Speaking of Purpose. So we want to give you the last word and ask you, what about this topic needs to be said?
So for me, I think it's perhaps follows on from our previous question, right? Where I think clearly sort of ESG and sustainability and social impact and corporate purpose is shifting into a sort of a new phase, right? It might be a more fragmented and risk-oriented phrase and perhaps more challenging in terms of managing expectations. But I think I would only like to underscore that I think this work remains critical, right? I think it's actually more critical than ever, and it will continue to deliver business value. It will continue to deliver societal value. And I think that long-term impact will simply hinge on, you know, being more disciplined in how it's executed, being perhaps more defensible and material in some of the language, and only being perhaps more deeply integrated into the core business, right? And I think that's perhaps what the future looks like in the face of sort of polarization and surface. So I really just want to underscore how critical this work is today and will continue to be despite the changing uncertain environment around us.
Thank you. It's a great message. Thank you. Thanks so much for tuning in. Make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to hear more stories of real people making real change. Till next time.